Hi, everyone. My name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. The other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. We could really use the help. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, though, I want to tell you about our new monthly guidebook / workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians, and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your career and your musical life on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from MyMusicMasterclass.com. So if you want to learn more, go to MyMusicMasterclass.com and you'll see the subscribe link in the menu. Click that and you'll be good to go. All right, so today we are here with Ray Levere, who is an old friend of mine. And, you know, I guess we met probably in the early 2000s, I'm thinking, at Smoke Jazz Club when I was playing there with Hot Pants. And Ray is a really, really great drummer. He's also got his hands in composition. He does a lot of that as well. And he's always busy, and he's got a great outlook on life. And Ray, how are you doing in this COVID apocalypse?
Doing good, man. First of all, Adam, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's an honor to first of all get a chance to hang and talk. It's been so long since we've seen each other, so it's great to catch up finally, and it's really good to be on the show to talk to the people out there and hopefully spread some positivity. And you know, everything that's going on right now, it's unprecedented craziness, and here we are, and how do we move forward and stay positive and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah, man. So for those of you, some of you know Ray, you know, that will be listening to this, or I've seen him on YouTube or in person, or you know, on the interwebs at this point, because there is no in person. Well, there's coming back, I guess. But for those of you who don't know Ray, Ray's got an amazing story, and I just want you to get some perspective here of what Ray has dealt with in his life getting up to the point he is. And then we're going to talk about all the cool stuff Ray's doing right now, which applies to everyone, because Ray is, you know, he's motivated and he's got a great attitude. You know, he's always doing different things. And so Ray, can you tell us a little bit about what happened to you as a child and what adversity you had to go through in order to be a professional musician?
Well, like the whole thing is just about the positivity thing you were talking about has always been a key thing for me after my accident. I came from a musical family. My sister played piano. My dad played piano. My aunt Barbara is an amazing pianist. She studied with Lenny Tristano in Chicoria, and, but music wasn't really a thing for me till 12 years old. The kid down the street was taking drum lessons, and I learned like a basic rock beat. And then I got caught in it was a clubhouse that we turned into a fort, and it was a chicken coop. So this chicken coop became our hangout, and we'd sleep out in it. And this one night in particular, a freaking candle just fell off the wall and like caught the whole place. And I was the last one to get out. And like, I had been sleeping 3 or 4 hours earlier than the rest of the guys, cause they stayed up later. It was my brother and a friend of ours. So, when I woke up, TR, my friend, and my brother had woken up, and they like ran out and they heard me screaming, and they came back in and basically pulled me out of the fire. And, so I spent 6 months 7 months in a burn unit in Westchester Medical Center. And my hope for survival was, you know, small to slim. And the doctor basically said to my mom, like, you know, I don't know if he's going to make it through the night. You know, he's been burned like over 50% of his body. And so my mom's just sitting there with these, you know, statistics, and, you know, it was just crazy. And I can't imagine, you know, what my mom went through. So fast forward 6 months later, they let me out of the hospital, and I had just started playing the drums. Like I said, I had like one drum beat together. And so like in the hospital, my mom was like, you know, when you get out, we'll get you the drum set. And it was like a positive anchor that we kept going toward, you know. And, cause it was like so much pain, just, you know, for anybody, let alone a 12-year-old kid, day in and day out. It's just, you know, trying to cover your upper body with skin again. And my lower body was okay. So the process was take skin from the lower part extremities and get it on the upper and cover them back up, so infection and all that stuff wouldn't kill me. So that was the game they were playing to save my life. And so my mom just kept, you know, throwing that out there with the drum set. You know, when you get out, you know, we'll get you a drum set. And my dad was like, yeah, we'll get you a drum set. And I had just been to a fair prior to that. And I think my dad was playing at the fair, and it was the Orange County Fair up in Orange County, New York. And so my dad was playing there, and I remember seeing him play. But then I went over to see some rock band, and there was some guy playing, and he had this huge chrome drum kit, this big chrome shiny kit, you know, and the lights on it. And it was just like this, one of my first images of seeing like this awesome looking drum kit. So I kind of held that image in my mind in the hospital, and I kept thinking of this kit, you know. And so I think it was my birthday or something, and they were trying to cheer me up, and they're like, what do you want for your birthday? And of course the drum set came up.
It's like, I want the striper drum set, please.
Totally. And I think, you know, in hindsight, the nurse actually was in the room helping, doing something, and she heard this conversation of, we'll get you a drum set when you get out. And the nurse pulled my father aside, unbeknownst to me, till later after I got out of the hospital. And she said, Mr. Levere, I don't think it's a good idea for you to get your son's hopes up, you know, and promise him things like drums and all that when he, you know, he doesn't have most of his fingers, and, you know, it's not a good idea to get his hopes up. And my father just looked at her and said, you don't know my son, and just walked away. And he told me that story later. And, you know, that's kind of my story in life. It's just like, nobody could tell you who you are and like what you're made of until you're tested, you know, and that's kind of life. Life kicks your ass in so many ways, and everybody's got their test. And, that's what gives you wisdom and experience and all that stuff later in life, is, you know, getting your butt kicked is a big part of it. So I was kind of handed all of it at 12 years old, you know, in terms of like,
insane. You know, you have to grow up real fast, right?
Exactly. And my mother always said, like, you became a man in the burn unit. You went in a child and you became out a man. You came out a man because, you know, it's just too many, you know, too much stuff to process as a 12-year-old. And, but what really saved me was having my parents, you know, good parents, and they really, you know, kept my head straight during the whole thing. And, you know, just everybody that pulled together was just unbelievable. My whole town, you know, my school, just everybody pulled together. They had a thing called Mawa Night. That was the town I was in at the time. And Mawa Night was the New Jersey Lakers and the New Jersey Nets. And they played together. Mm-hmm. And all the money from that night was to go to me and, you know, my accident and a trust fund and all that. And then they sold chocolate at one point, and the proceeds went to help me and all the costs from the burn unit and everything. And so that was my trial, my test of survival. And people say, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you did it. And it's like, I don't know either. You just, when you're in it, you're in it, you know? And it's like, you want to get out of it. It's like, you'll pull your pants up and you're like, all right, we got to get out of here. So let's do what we got to do. And that kind of became my life at 12 years old.
There was two paths you could have went, right? Like, and you chose the one that made you a lot happier. You didn't go into a spiral of depression.
Well, it was kind of black and white, because I realized, like, if I went south and went depressed and, you know, like, which isn't my game in the first place, I was never that kid. But if I went there, that's like sink or swim. There's just no turning back. It's like, that's not the path I want to go down. So that wasn't even an option that I gave myself. It was always like, what's going to get me out of here is like just doing what I got to do, doing the work. And I did the work to get out of there. And a lot of the work was just putting up with pain. And so that helped me later in life for, you know, a lot of things, you know, and it toughens you up. And, you know, it's very cliche to say, but what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And it's very true. When I was a kid, like being in a hospital for 6 months, if someone told me that, I would have been like, you know, scared of my boots, because like me in hospitals when I was a kid, like the thought of going to a hospital or a dentist was just like, I was afraid of hospitals and dentists and needles. And like, I don't know why, but like, I probably my brother tortured me like when I was a kid, just saying stuff like, you know, older brother stuff. He would say like my baby teeth fell out and be like, nope, that's it. You don't get new teeth. I'd be like, what? No. You know, and I'd go to my dad and like, you know, that was kind of the upbringing I had with an older brother. You know, I was always afraid of hospitals. So here I am 12 years old and I'm stuck in the hospital and like, you know, people are giving me slim chances of survival and my whole life changed in a second. So gratitude is a big part of my life today because, you know, your life can change in a second and, you know, lots of people's lives have, including mine. So.
Yeah, man. But that's just the beginning of your story, right? I mean, well, first of all, there's, you know, you're just a really talented musician. You've got a great feel and you're easy to play with as a bass player. You know, that's how I feel. When I watch you play, I can see how you've figured out how to deal with it. You put rubber bands on your hands, right? Do you still do that?
I'll go through the quick process. Sure. I had an operation done on my left hand because it was basically a mitten from all the covering up in the hospital, and they took half of my digits. So the whole hand just kind of turned into a mitten. And then I basically started by sticking my hand into a glove and duct taping the stick just to be able to strike the instrument. And it was basically a dead fish. Later on, after taking lessons, I decided to get a thumb, you know, and they basically at the Shriners Burn Unit pulled out the thumb and, you know, did a graft on it. So now I have this very basic pincher, but that basic pincher of my thumb like was a game changer. And now I can hold the stick and I use this glue. It's basically wig glue that gives me a much more sticky positive grip. So if I'm doing a jazz gig, I don't use the rubber band because I'm putting sticks down and I'm picking up brushes and I'm trying to play with finesse and, you know, but if I'm doing a rock gig, you know, it's the insurance that if I'm in the middle of a crazy solo or something, I don't want the stick popping out. And then, so like I've devised a system where I, with this thumb pinch grip that I have on my left hand, I bring this rubber band. It's a 64 weight, by the way. And I figured out the right weight to give it just enough to hold it in there, but not tight enough where it's cutting circulation off. So I found out the right weight and, so I just basically put it around the stick and it goes around the back of my hand and then around the butt of the stick. And it literally takes me less than a second to go and put the rubber band on. So that's the process that I've come up with the left hand. And the right hand has always had more digits and grip. So it's just a limited wrist movement. So I've learned to really kind of figure that out. Figuring that out for me was to take the total technical route of like learning the rudiments and like really studying all the rudiments and like studying the guys like Buddy Rich and Vinnie Caliuta and Steve Gadd and, you know, guys that had incredible technique. I wanted to know what they were doing and I wanted to try to emulate that sound because that's what I was hearing. And I knew that if I shot for the moon and I hit the mountain, that would be okay. So I went after these guys that had incredible technique to study, you know, Billy Cobham, Tony Williams, lots of people that were on a whole nother level, Philly Joe Jones, just, and I studied, you know, I just practiced really hard again, you know, it was like just hard work, you know, and continues to be.
To me, this is incredibly inspiring. And I know that you also speak, you do engagements, right? This is just one of those things where everyone has a certain Well, not everyone. I guess some people don't have adversity, but I would hope that, you know, that I think everyone has some sense of adversity. But to the level of what you've overcome and your never give up attitude, plus, like, we're friends on Facebook and all that, and I just saw that you had like a half pipe or something built. You're just constantly doing crazy shit, which is awesome. You have this amazing attitude of, like, you know, you just go for it. There's plenty of people that have never had adversity that are scared shitless of going out of their comfort zone. It seems like you embrace going out of your comfort zone, or
I do embrace going out of my comfort zone. And for me, that's where I'm alive, you know. And it's like the point, what is it? David Bowie says you got to walk out in the water till you get right up where you can't breathe and you feel like you're going to go under. And he said, that's where you want to be. You want to be right there. And it's right on the edge, you know, it's right where, you know, things happen. That's where the spark happens for me. So, like, I've always gravitated toward, when I was a kid, I was into like BMX, and I excelled at it because, again, I was hanging out with kids older than me and I was trying to just keep up with them. I was really good at just, you know, I was just a scrappy kid that just, you know, was on his bike all the time. And then I get into BMX and it turns out I was fast because I was on my bike all the time. So I really got into BMX and, you know, I was just into life and playing outside and, you know, just being a kid. And I never lost that, you know, even as I've grown up. Like, I just built a half pipe in my backyard. Like, I had a mini ramp, and a friend of mine built a half pipe in his backyard and he's renting. And I was like, why would you build that thing in your backyard when you're renting? And he's like, no, the landlord's cool. Then the next day he's like, well, the landlord says I got to take it down and get the hell out of there. He's like, can I put it in your yard? And I was like, dude, bring it on. Why not? So he has a friend that, you know, built it, and he already bought the lumber. So I was like, game on, let's do this. So I had the space. I have like 2 acres here. You know, it's been good that I have a lot of space during the whole COVID thing and everything. But so anyway, the ramp showed up in my yard, and we built it, and that's kind of been our summer COVID project. And so now it's done, and I've been skating it for like a couple of weeks now, and it's completely amazing.
You fuck yourself up at all?
No way, not yet. But you know, we're one day at a time. But no, there's a lot of similarities that I found in skateboarding and like, and drumming and music and you know, things that just kind of keep you on your toes. Like dropping on a skateboard is like, wow, this could be like disaster, train wreck, or it could go smooth. And that's like when, you know, for instance, with music, it's like, boom, that, you know, the tempo kicks off and you're like, here we go, yeah. You know, and like you're in and you can't think about, can I make it? You know, it's like, as soon as you think about something, it's like you've gone to the glove box to look at the manual and you're like flying along in a jet airplane. It doesn't work that way. You have to stay with it, you know? So that's kind of what skateboarding does for me. It keeps me like on that thing. And anyway, yeah, that's, you know, what I think about when I'm soloing is like, don't fall, you know, stay up, you know? And it's like, so we all have our methods of,
Dropping in is one of those things too, where you actually have to lean forward, which is really not what you inherently want to do. If you, you know, you're on the top of a cliff, if you lean back, you fall right in your head.
Yeah. Well, the board scoots out. And you land up. But you know, I pad up, I got elbow pads, I got knee pads, I have padded shorts, I have like this great helmet. And, you know, so I just, you know, try to have fun and like, that's my exercise. You know, it's like I go to my ramp in the backyard and I jogged for a while. I was running for a long time and I was running in the woods because it's more of an agility thing. And like you do use different muscles and then I kind of hurt my back. So I had to like rethink things. And so running kind of took a back seat, but skating, you know, if you don't fall, there's no, you know, you're not jumping up. It's no, there's no jump. It's very smooth, and if you don't fall, of course.
Yeah. Let's talk about some career stuff, because you know we've hung out quite a bit, and you know, you're a very good people person, I've noticed. And I always talk on this podcast, Jake and I have talked about it many times, that it's really, really important to make friends in the industry, you know, I mean, or just in the scene, in order to get gigs. And you play with your friends, and you know, how important, I know that I'm sure it comes natural to you, but how important do you think it is to have a good attitude and just to be likable?
I think it's everything. I mean, you know, I've seen it time and time again that, you know, there's some amazing guys, and like you see them and they're like, oh, that guy's getting all the gigs. But then when you hear the behind the scenes stories, you're like, well, that guy got fired because he was mouthing off, even though he's the most amazing drummer on the planet that everybody knows. And you hear stories like that and you're like, wow, it happens on all levels. So, and it's really how you network. Like you said, like your friends are the ones that are going to hire you. And it's like based on, you know, how you get the big gig, you know, it's really based on who, a friend of a friend of a friend or somebody along the way that, thinks you're a cool hang, you know? I mean, yes, you have to play your instrument on a certain level and that's, you know, that's just par for the course, but then it's like, can you hang, you know? And that's a big part of it that, you know, I remember John Reilly told me, not everybody can be a musician. And I didn't know what he meant. And that's what he meant. Like, some people don't know how to hang. They're just amazing on their instrument, but they can't hang, you know?
Did you study with John?
I did. I studied at him. I went to William Patterson.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I
studied with John for, had the honor of studying with him for like a good 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Morris Arnold was my other instructor, who was also amazing. Rufus Reed was there at the time, and it was just amazing to be there.
I think Vic was there too, right?
Yes, Vic was there. Vic Juris was there. Lucas was there teaching like jazz ear training, and this guy just, like, I just remember we had to sing the Bach two-part invention, and I had to sing the bass, and he had to sing the treble, and like, you had to like do your homework and sit there and know your part, and you would be like, all right, close the book and sing, you know, and you'd have to like know the whole thing. And like, I failed miserably. You know, but, like, it was, I felt like I got thrown in with the lions at William Patterson, because, you know, there's some guys that were really on a high level when they were there to begin with. And like, I had never played with any jazz musicians except my father. And he played the organ and, you know, played the bass with his feet. My dad's an amazing jazz organ player, and he basically, I did my jury tape with him to you know, for my application, and they accepted me, but I'd never played with an upright bass player or, you know, any horn players or anything. So I just like, it was kind of like a hidden secret. I didn't want to be found out, so I was like scrambling to try to get better, you know, and learn as much as I could. And that was an amazing experience.
So let's skip to some other things you've been doing recently. You've been writing for television, or are they cues and spots for commercials? I did some of that work myself, so I'm curious.
Yeah, I call them cues. They're just 1 minute, 1 minute, 30 second grooves, you know, section A, section B. And it's very, you know, just simple formulaic kind of thing that the editors are looking for. So it's not like you're really writing a song. They're just feels. And I'm instructed as to what type of genre they need for, like, crime shows. There's a very specific kind of weird, you know, thing you have to do that's a little bit eerie, and, you know, and then there's straight up rock cues, and then there's like hip hop. There's all these weird things that, you know, you kind of stick together that work for television. And, But it's very basic, and I try to, you know, try to just like belt them out every day. And it's kind of a volume thing, like, doesn't really pay that much. But, you know, if you're submitting all the time, and your audio house is doing their homework with getting you the gigs, you know, your cues get right up there, you know, pretty quick. So the turnaround rate is pretty decent.
And so what are you doing on these cues? Do you sequence a lot of the things and just play drums, or are you playing any other instruments with it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a few different processes. Basically, what I do is a lot of in-the-box stuff with synths. I have Spectrasonics and a whole bunch of other sounds. It's all about the sounds, you know, and mm-hmm. It's like a gazillion sounds that I have that I can just be like, oh, it needs that, or it needs this, and there's kind of like MIDI guitars I have, and it's different each time, but you know, sometimes it starts with a marimba lick. Sometimes it starts with a drum groove. Sometimes I don't even play the drums, you know, it's just like loops that I've created in the past. I'll be like, oh, I just need a 180 rock loop, you know, and I kind of have a whole big library of loops that I've made. So, because a lot of them are just boonket, 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 and that's all I need for the whole thing. And so it's like, why play it again if I already have it? So it's a, you know, category of cataloging and, you know, sounds and knowing what you need and working really fast, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I did. I wrote for a lot of shows and they would do the same thing. They'd say, I need 20 cues that sound like Blink 182 or that sound. I need tension music because roommates are fighting, or I need this. Right, and then you just write 1 minute and 30 second songs that had a solid ending, no fade outs, like, you know, you send to stems. It's a game. I mean, but I always liked it because, you know, you have a schedule and you know your job and you just pump it out, right?
Right. It's a different way to work. You know, it's not like you're recording a song where it's like, oh, wait, I could do that solo a little better. You know, and it's just like, boom, just like, you know, record it, pull it out of your butt like you've been on tour for the last 3 months, you know? And that's kind of like, that's a hard way to work, to like force yourself to just railroad through something, not, you know, to get it done, you know, and do a sloppy job, but like do a great job fast, you know. And there's like tricks that I use that I've learned. My buddy Rich Tozzoli, he has over, geez, like 500,000 cues that he's done. And he's just such a pro at it. He's an amazing guitarist, amazing engineer. And he mixed for Al Di Meola and a whole bunch of people that he remixed the Spiders from Mars, Bowie DVD. I mean, the guy's just amazing. He wrote a book on how to mix and Pro Tools. And so I had the honor of kind of studying under this guy. And he like kind of showed me the whole ropes. And yeah, so I've been really fortunate. And again, it's, you know, it's who you know. And it's being a good guy and a good hang and not being a jerk, because nobody wants to hang out with a jerk, right?
No, or do them favors. So what have you been doing during this quarantine? Have you been, you know, breaking your time up between cues? Is that something you do every day? You've been practicing new stuff? You know, tell me about the musical stuff first and then about the stuff to keep your head straight, like exercise and half pipes.
Yeah. I wake up every day with the intention of writing a tune. Most days it happens, some days it doesn't. And so like the cool thing about being self-employed is, and just like today's a day where I'm just going to go and have a me day, and, you know, and that's an honor and a privilege to be able to do that. And, you know, that's, to me, that's living the dream. So I feel like I've, you know, I'm really blessed the life that I have, but, you know, I try to write every day. And recently during the whole COVID thing, I've really been practicing the marimba more and the vibraphone, practicing the drums a whole bunch, and just going back and revisiting things and going through drum books that I haven't looked at in many years, you know, as a student. Just kind of like preparing for when things open up again. I'm just remaining positive that, you know, it's just like things are going to spring back eventually. How fast, we don't know, but might as well keep the sword sharp and just keep, you know, practicing and acting as if, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that's been your attitude all along, you know, and it's definitely the one I've adopted, and I'm hoping more people have, you know. There's no reason to be complacent, especially because as soon as the doors open, it's going to be, everyone's going to run out of the gates. And if you don't have things that you've been working on, it's kind of a lost time. We don't know how long it's going to be, right, for this vaccine. So,
no, there's a lot of unforeseens right now. So, I think a lot of people are imploding, and I think a lot of people are digging on a much deeper level and thinking about their lives on a much deeper level and their families and like what's important, you know. And I've kind of contemplated on all that and like the rat race and how we struggle so hard to like get ahead and do our thing, you know, in the world and make our mark, whatever that is. And, you know, it's like I find myself like, that's a big part of who I am. But, you know, the other part is just the opposite of not doing any of that. It's just like taking some me time and like relaxing, meditating and breathing and, you know, stretching and doing exercising and doing all the stuff that you need to do for yourself to, because it's body, mind, and spirit, right? I mean, you got to have all three of those to be complete and whole. So it's just staying positive, you know, and every day just keeping your focus on something, you know, holding yourself accountable for like, all right, I'm going to do this, you know, I'm going to write this song in the morning, and then I got to exercise, so I'm going to do this, and then I got to do some yard work, I got to pull some weeds, you know, take care of some whatever. It's like it all has to happen in its own time. So that's where I'm at, man. I'm just, you know, it's kind of weird. It's just like I'm here and I haven't really been affected in the sense because it's business as usual with writing TVQs and practicing and like, you know, skating in the backyard and like, you know, taking care of the dogs and going hiking and all that stuff. And that's kind of the life I've set up for myself. Like when I was all the way back in college, like one of the things I wanted was like a small house in the woods so I can practice without bothering anybody. And that was like a goal that I wanted. And like you saw my house, I don't live there anymore, but like you came up and you saw my little house in the woods and we made some beautiful sounds in that basement.
Sure, man. I hope they were beautiful. You know, I did my best.
Nah, man, it was a lot of fun. I think of Al, you and I, and the group we had for a little while, and we played out a couple things, a couple places. That was fun.
Yeah. So, I mean, talking about meditation, we've spoken about this with different people. What kind of meditation do you do?
I just kind of do like a Kriya yoga thing, which basically is like a spiritual form of yoga where you just kind of focus on the eternal Om, the third eye, and connecting with flow of the universe, which is everything. And like, I've kind of been on this quest my whole life of like, how do you get to flow? How do you get to flow? Cause like as a musician, you're always trying to get the flow happening. And like, there's always one person that gets in your way and it's yourself, you know? So I'm like, you know, you have this conversation with yourself, you know, I don't know, like what kind of conversations you've had with yourself, you know, struggling or not struggling to get up in the world. But there was a lot of struggling on my part because I started the game late. I really didn't start practicing till I was 18 and I knew that I was way behind and I had a lot of catching up to do. And I'm like, here I am in William Patterson and I'm like acting like I know about standards and like, I don't have a clue. I'm basically clueless. And so like, it was a lot of catch up, you know, so. And I still kind of feel that way. I feel like, you know, not that I'm catching up, but I just, there's a lifetime of music that is just, you know, it's just lifetimes of music to, you know, and the more you know, the less you don't. So it's like,
yeah, that's just a wise philosophy though. That's kind of how everyone that gets to a certain level feels that they even have more to learn than when they were younger.
Right. Cause your vision opens, you're wise. And it's like, you know, that's kind of the beauty of the whole thing for me is like, you know, when I was younger, I had ego, I had attitude because I was protecting my thing and whatever. And you get older and you're like, wow, you know, you just see that there's such a bigger world and view. And it's like your small little mind can't grasp it. And then when you get older, it opens up a little. And, you know, so that's kind of what I would say to like guys coming up, you know, it's like be in it and experience all the experiences and like, pay attention and like, you know, remain teachable, you know, and like stay out of the ego area because that's where, you know, you start protecting your stuff and there's nothing to protect. What are you protecting?
Yeah. I feel like ego comes from thinking that it's a finite system and you're going to get there first. It's fucking not, it's not finite. It's going to keep going.
For me, it's not a I win, you lose, you know, it's not that scenario. So you've lost if you're thinking that way.
Tell me about kind of what you're doing now. I know you have a couple records out as a solo artist, and you know, let's pretend that you know there was no COVID or whatever. What happens? I mean, what are you planning on doing in terms of with other people? Are you making a new record in the works? You've been writing songs, or do you have some other things planned?
Well, I was I'm in the process of writing some new stuff. I had a couple tracks that I did with Mike Stern and Will Lee and Etienne Stabak on keys. And we did one of my tunes and one of Mike's tunes. And so I have two in the can, and I've been writing, you know, other tunes for the record. And then the whole COVID thing kind of came and just kind of put a kibosh on my plans for like going in the studio to record some stuff. But it's kind of nice because it made me step back and just be like, all right, no need to like run out and put a new record out. Like, what's the hurry? Like, take your time. And, you know, so that's one of the benefits of COVID, was just got me to just relax and chill and think about things, you know, and not do anything with a knee jerk reaction. So that's kind of my goal in the future, is like, make sure it's done right. And, you know, just take your time with it and enjoy the process. Again, you know, success, I think, is just nothing more than enjoying your life and enjoying the process. It's not a destination. Like, you know, when I was younger, I always used to think when I'm older, I'll have, and I'll feel, and I'll, you know, you think of all these things that'll be great, but then you're older, but you're still you. And it's like, it's only, it just, you realize it's what you make it, and that's it, you know? So you could go to some gig and there's two people in the audience and they're cranking the big screen TVs and you're like, motherfucker, you know? And it's like, but it's like, out of like,
it is what it is, man.
It is what it is. It's yeah. Just like, you know, and that's your life. No one promised you golden gigs, you know?
Yeah. You just got to be happy making music, right? I mean, that's kind of the thing. And once you, if you get to the point where you're not happy making music, you got to rethink things.
I mean, the joy is in the journey. It's true. It's the, you know, that's a cliche term, but it's so true. It's like, you know, you got to enjoy what you're doing, because that's like, that's when audience members, like, they feel your vibe, you know, like I used to go to see you guys, the Hot Pants, and you guys would just be tearing the roof off the place. And it was all about you guys. Vibe was just so chill and just relaxed and having a good time. And it was like this party band that you just wanted to be a part of. And like, you know, then on break you guys would come out in the audience and you're all, you guys were like really cool and chill. And you know, so I learned a lot from just going to see you guys and going to see everybody, all my friends. And like, you know, I was just listening to your interview with Ari Honig, and like, he's an all-time friend as well. And like, I've known Arnie for years, and like, you know, back in the days. And
was he at William Patterson when you were?
No, he wasn't, but I forgot when he was, but
yeah, like 92 or something like that, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm glad he wasn't, because I would have been scared.
He's a scary man. I mean, on the kit, he's a beautiful man, but you know, beautiful guy
on a whole nother level, you know, of just an amazing musical drummer, like kind of a modern day Max Roach. Just all about the music. And you know, he's a guy who's all about the hang and the vibe. And like, it's just, you know, it's, you want to be around someone like that, you know. And you, like, you know, I had an instant rapport with you. First of all, bass players and drummers tend to have that anyway, but like, I don't have that with everybody,
right?
Like, you meet somebody and it's like, oh, here's an old bud that I haven't seen in a while, and you get that feeling when you meet them. And so that's, you know, that's where good music happens in my mind. You know, that's when you're relaxed enough and you're just, you're having fun with your buds. That's when the magic happens, I think, you know?
Yeah, and, man. You know, this is another thing I thought about. It's cool. And I appreciate all the kind words, by the way. I'm just glossing over them because I'm so embarrassed. You've always exuded a lot of confidence on the kit or just personally. And I know that we've talked recently, we had a performance psychologist on the show, which was cool. And we asked him what the difference between cockiness, or where the fine line between confidence and cockiness was. And I'm wondering if there was a point when your younger self met your older self, you know, and you had that, that switch over, or were you ever cocky or arrogant, or and did you become just genuinely confident at a certain point, or were you kind of always that way?
That's a good question, because there's kind of two parts of who I am. Is like before the accident and after. And like before the accident, you know, I was like a really good looking kid, and like I was very good at talking to people, like you said, and I had a lot of charm, and like my father's very charming, and he's, you know, just can talk it up with anybody. And I think that's kind of where I got my stuff from. So I kind of used that to my advantage as a kid. And so I guess I was like kind of cocky, and I guess, I mean, I was like a child of the 70s, where, and it was a lot different back then. And like, there was some issues at home where my parents were just so busy and they didn't have time to keep after me. And I was a kid that needed keeping after. And I decided to, like, I don't want to go to school today. So I just get on my bike, and you know, I was in second or third grade. It's like, what kid does that? You know, and kind of me, I was like, I don't care. I want to ride my bike. And I knew there'd be consequences, but I just didn't feel like going to school that day. I wanted to hang out with my sister's older friends, you know? So I think I kind of learned to be like, I remember wanting to grow up as a kid and wanting to be, you know, tough and all this stuff. And Fonzie was my idol, and Evel Knievel, and like, you know, cool. You know, I wanted to be cool, and I wanted to be cool with the older kids. So like, I found myself, you know, trying to like grow up too quick. And like, so like all the older kids started getting into BMX. So that's when I was like, well, I want to do it too. So like, I tried to keep up with them. And so that's how I became like this kid that didn't want to lose. I was like, you know, kind of getting hazed by the older kids. So I had this toughness, I guess. And then after the accident, I think that toughness really helped me to, you know, to stand my ground. Cause after I got out, you know, it's like, here I am now, I'm a burn victim, and like, I don't look the way I used to. And now people are looking at me for other reasons. You know, they're staring at me because they don't like the way I look, or they think I look funny. And now I have to psychologically deal with that as a 12-year-old. And, you know, that's where everybody came together. My mom, my dad, you know, my school and my town, everybody came together to like really prepare me to come back into town. And they had like doctors and nurses come to my school and say, look, he's coming back and he has scars. And like, they prepared the children. So like, everybody came together for me, and it really helped me in the long run. My parents kind of took care of me psychologically. And like, I guess I was tough enough as a kid to handle it. And, I was just this kid that always was falling and like, you know, hitting my head, and just a very scrappy kid. Like, here I am in a hospital bed, and like, okay, I got hurt really bad. How do we get out of here? You know, and all I kept thinking about was riding my bike, you know, riding a motorcycle, you know, just like things I would do when I got out. And that's what all I focused on. So for anybody who's in a spot of negativity, like, you gotta get your mind off of that, and you gotta get out of that to focus on something positive, because wherever you look, that's what you see, you know? And, so I knew that as a 12-year-old kid that I had to like think positively, or I was going to like sink or swim. So I had guidance of a lot of great adults in my life that really helped me and, made me understand that it wasn't fair what happened to me. So as a 12-year-old, again, I realized life isn't fair. And it's like, you don't get everything you want. You know, it's just one day you're a 12-year-old kid, next day you're thinking about all these deep things, you know, right. It's like, and you're, you know, hoping you're going to survive. So,
yeah, I mean, that's a crazy lesson for a 12-year-old to learn. And, you know, life surely isn't fair, right? I mean, but it's hard to say, but I guess it could have been worse, right?
Yeah, that's what I always said to myself. It could have been a lot worse. And that's whatever happens to you. I don't know who you are. I don't care who you are. You know, it could always be worse. You know, if you lost a leg, you could have lost both. You know, if you lost the arm, well, shit, I could have lost. And I lost a lot of digits on my hands. And like, you know, the doctor basically said he couldn't get himself to take all of my fingers off, because he said I should have. They were burned so bad. But he said, he literally sat down next to my bed and like looked at my hands and he's like, I can't do this to this kid. I can't take his hands off. So he left as much as he could on the right hand and he left as much as he could on the left hand. And he left more on the right because he knew I was righty. And so, you know, but my hands are kind of, you know, I'm so used to my hands being this way that they're, you know, they're not, I don't think in terms of my hand as they're not normal. Like this has been normal for me since 12 years old. And like, there's not much I can't do. You know, I've kind of like proven to myself through the years, there's been things that I wanted to do for myself to prove that I could do it. And one of them was getting a motorcycle license. So, because I was always into bikes as a kid and now I wanted to get a street bike. So I got a bike and I took lessons and, you know, I took my, my test and I failed the first time because, I didn't turn my head to look before I turned or whatever. But then I went back and I passed the second time and I rode this bike like all over the place and like went on tons of bike trips and had like the most amazing time with some friends of mine. And like, that's, again, that's, you know, that was one of the dreams I had. And like, you know, it's important to have achievable dreams, I think, you know, like doing those things. That's what makes life for me is having, what's the next thing that's going to like inspire me to, you know, work at something and have a good time doing it and like accomplish something and like have that great feeling of like finishing something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you could also combine some of this stuff, like drop in your half pipe with the motorcycle if you want to take it to the next level.
And then the backflip.
I mean, if you liked Evel Knievel, you said that he was your idol. I mean, why can't you do that, right? Come on, man.
I'll see if I can put it together.
That we've talked about so much, but I want to know kind of like your advice for cats breaking into the scene, because you've done a lot of different things. You're a versatile cat. Like we played some funk gigs. You know, you're in the straight ahead jazz scene. You know, you've done a lot of different stuff. You know, your last record had John Abercrombie on it too, right?
Yep.
Like, what is your advice to younger cats that are, you know, struggling to just get into the scene? And I don't know if anyone asked you that question, you know, when you teach or anything like that, but that's a big one I hear.
No, I get that question all the time from students. And again, it's just, you know, being polite, being kind, and being a good person, and just, you know, respecting the pecking order, and you know, knowing that someone's been in the gig for a while, there's a reason they've been there, and learning from that person, like, what is that reason? And if you hang out with them, you'll realize, you know, again, it comes back to like, you know, being a good guy and being a good hang, and, you know, just wanting to be around that person. And maybe not geek out and talk about music when you're not on stage, but talk about skateboarding or fishing or, you know, whatever you're knitting, whatever you're into, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's what makes for good music, is just, you know, all the great bands in the world that, you know, from the Beatles to Led Zeppelin to, you know, that there's like quirky characters in the mix that create a spice that, if that spice is gone, it just tastes different. You know, the taste is gone. So it's like there's a band element that is not about you. It's about the group as a whole. And that's what I've always tried to, you know, bring the music up to, like uplifting it as a whole. And, you know, when I used to go see you guys, like you guys would just be like a unit, a machine, and the whole place would be swaying. And like, you know, when you experience that, it's heavy, man. You walk into a room and you're like, damn, it's just, you can just feel the energy. And, that doesn't happen through being like a virtuosic player or any of that. That gets in the way, if anything. Like, you know, what makes it groove is just like, just being able to let it simmer on the stove and just, you know, let it cook. And like, my teacher, study with this guy Sal LaRocca in New Jersey, and he was the guy that really like just was like rudiments. And you know, I was afraid of the guy the first lesson, and I lied to him and basically told him I can't take lessons because I was so afraid of him. He looked like Charles Bronson and I thought he was going to kill me. And I wasn't serious at the time. I was in high school and like I remember once I was like, some kid had a joint and he's like, you want to smoke a joint out back? And I'm like, sure. And I'm taking a puff and I'm like, I have a drum lesson. Oh no. So I like run down there and I'm high and this, and like, he knows I'm high and I'm like, I didn't practice. And he's like, what's the matter with you? And I'm like waiting for him to pull out his gun. And I'm like, so anyway, I like stopped studying with him. And cause I just wanted to be a rock star. You know, I was like, my head was up my butt. And so like, I was in this rock band and they like basically chewed me up and spit me out. And I called them back and I was like, I think I want to play jazz and I think I want to go to school to learn jazz because it's really hard music. Can you help me? So that was like kind of like the introduction. And then I studied with him again. And like, you know, I studied with him for like 6 years straight, two lessons a week. And like, you know, he said, jump, I'd say how high. I was in like 8 books. And like, he had me in like 3 different CDs of like, you know, different drummers from Art Blakey to Tony Williams. And he was like checking, he was getting me to check everybody out. And like, and so I just started learning a lot as much as I could. And long story short is just learn as much as you can, you know, and just be a good guy and be polite and show up on time and, you know, say thank you and don't be a dick. It's pretty simple.
Don't be a dick. You know, that's great. That's a great way to end this one, I think, right? Thanks so much, man, for coming on. And you know, when this storm settles, which any day now, I'm sure. No, but when this storm settles, we gotta hang, man. You're local now. There's some really good cafes in Nyack too, man. I like them.
Yeah, good cafes and anytime, man. If you want to come by, you know, sooner than later, man. I got some property here. We could have a little picnic in the backyard. Ooh.
Sounds enticing.
You know what I'm thinking is like the next virus after this will be digital, so we won't be able to do anything on the internet. We'll have to go hang out with each other. That'll be awesome. It'll like balance it out, you know.
It's a funny concept. Well, thanks so much, brother, and we will talk soon.
Thanks, man. It's an honor to be on your show, bro. Thank you so much for thinking of me, and I had a great time, dude. Thank you so much.
It's nice to meet you.
Likewise. All the best, guys. Thanks, man.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail? You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformancepathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So, look forward to hearing from you.